friends of mine circulated that I had fled to Israel. In fact, I did not then, and would not for quite a few more years, even cross the border into Canada or Mexico, much less travel overseas. But this was another of those stories that would become part of the legend, another untrue fact of my history that would later be used to convince judges not to grant me bail. My hosts in Oroville, Jesse and Duke, were retired, living on a homestead of half an acre in a farming area. Nice people, but very set in their ways. The days were precise in their routine. Up at 5 o'clock every morning, cornbread and milk for breakfast. After dinner, watch game shows on TV. No computer, no modem, no ham radio. Tough for a kid like me, but way better than being behind the walls of a youth authority facility. The couple kept chickens and pigs and had 2 dogs. To me, it felt like Green Acres. I swear one of their pigs looked exactly like Arnold, the pig on the show. Obviously, I couldn't drive, since the only license I had was in my real name and there was a warrant out for my arrest. So to get around the neighborhood, I bought a bike. I'd ride to the local library and spend hours reading. For something else to keep my mind engaged, I signed up for a course at the local college in criminal justice. The instructor was a sitting criminal court judge in Butte County. During the course, he played tapes of confessions and then lectured how naive the suspects were to talk to the police without a lawyer. He once said, "Most criminals believe they can talk their way out of trouble." I smiled, knowing that was great advice. It amused me to wonder what he would have thought if he had found out that a student sitting in the front row of the class had a fugitive warrant out for him. I stuck with the Green Acres lifestyle for 4 months, until a call to my attorney confirmed that he had received a copy of the CYA discharge paper indicating they no longer had jurisdiction over me. The attorney pointed out that it was a dishonorable discharge. I just laughed. Who'd give a damn if it was dishonorable? It was never that honorable to start with. It's not like I'd left the armed forces. Within days, I was back in Los Angeles, full of anticipation. Lenny DeCicco had landed a job at Hughes Aircraft as a computer operator, and he was eager for me to come over and visit. Even better, Lenny said he had something to share with me, something he didn't want to tell me over the phone. I wondered what it could be. 6. We'll hack for love. In his time at Hughes Aircraft, Lenny DeCicco told me he had become buddy-buddy with a lady security guard. I was to come see him on a night when this lady would be on duty and say I was a deck employee. When I showed up, she signed me in with a wink, not asking to see any ID. Lenny arrived to escort me from the lobby, barely able to control his excitement, but still arrogant and full of himself. He led me to a Hughes VAX computer that had access to the ARPANET, linking a collection of universities, research labs, government contractors, and the like. Typing commands, he told me he was accessing a computer system called DocMaster, which was owned by the National Computer Security Center, NCSC, a public arm of the super-secret National Security Agency. We were elated, knowing that this was the closest we'd ever come to establishing a real connection to the NSA. Bragging about his social engineering, Lenny said he had pretended to be a member of the National Computer Security Center's IT team and conned a worker there named T. Arnold into revealing his credentials to the system. Lenny was practically dancing with pride. He was still such a geek. It seemed like he must be high on some great dope when he boasted, "I'm as good a social engineer as you are, Kevin." We fished around for maybe an hour, but came up only with uninteresting information. Much later, that hour would come back to haunt me. I was sure there was some way I could fast-track my computer skills to something that could land me a job I coveted, working for General Telephone. I found out the company was actively recruiting graduates from a technical school called the Computer Learning Center. It was an easy drive from my place, and I could earn a certificate by going to school there for only 6 months. A federal Pell Grant plus a student loan paid my way, and my mom came up with the bread for some of the extra expenses. The school required male students to wear a suit and tie to class every day. I hadn't dressed like that since my bar mitzvah at age 13, and now, since I was 23 and fairly beefed out, that suit would have been a pretty miserable fit. Mom's cash paid for 2 new suits. I really enjoyed programming in assembler language, more challenging because the programmer has to master many technical details, but yielding much more efficient code that uses a much smaller memory footprint. Coding in this lower-level language was fun. It felt like I had more control over my applications. I was coding much closer to the machine level than using a higher-level programming language such as COBOL. The classwork was routine to somewhat challenging, but also fascinating. I was doing what I loved, learning more about computer systems and programming. When the subject of hacking came up every now and then, I played dumb, just listening. But of course, I was continuing to hack. I had been playing cat-and-mouse games with Pacific Bell, as the former Pacific Telephone had restyled itself. Every time I figured out a new way of getting into the company's switches, somebody there would eventually figure out a way of blocking my access. I'd use the dial-up numbers that RCMAC was using to connect to various switches to process service orders, and they'd catch on, then change the dial-up numbers or restrict them so I couldn't dial in. And then I would remove the restriction when they weren't paying attention. It went back and forth for months. Their constant interference had gotten to the point where hacking into Pacific Bell switches was getting to be more like work. Then I got the idea of trying out a higher-level approach, attacking their switching control center system, or SCCS. If I could do that, I'd have just as much control as if I'd been sitting in front of the switches themselves, able to do whatever I wanted without having to social engineer clueless technicians day after day. Ultimate access and power could be mine. I started with an attack aimed at the SCCS at Oakland in Northern California. On my first call, I planned to say I was from ESAC, the Electronic Systems Assistance Center, providing support for all the SCCS software deployed throughout the company. So I did my research, coming up with the name of a legit ESAC worker, then claiming, I need to get into the Oakland SCCS, but our data kit equipment is down for maintenance, so I'll have to get access through dial-up. No sweat. The man I had reached gave me the dial-up number and a series of passwords and stayed on the line with me, talking me through each step. Oops. This was a system with dial-back security. You had to enter a phone number and wait for the computer to ring you back. What now? Look, I'm off-site at a remote office, I said off the top of my head, so I won't be able to take a call back. I had magically hit on a reasonable-sounding excuse.
Sure, I can program it to bypass the dial-back when you log in with your username, he assured me, defeating the company's elaborate security that would otherwise have required that I be at an authorized callback number.
Lenny joined me in the SCCS break-in effort. Each one we got into gave us access to 5 or 6 central office switches with full control over them, so we were able to do anything a tech who was in the CO could do, sitting at the switch. We could trace lines, create new phone numbers, disconnect any phone number, add or remove custom calling features, set up traps and traces, and access logs from traps and traces. A trap and trace is a feature placed on a line that captures incoming numbers, usually placed on customers' lines if they are the victim of harassing phone calls. Lenny and I put a huge amount of time into this, from late 1985 through much of 1986. We eventually got into the switches for all of Pacific Bell, then Manhattan, then Utah and Nevada, and in time many others throughout the country. Among these was the Chesapeake and Potomac Telephone Company, or C&P, which served the Washington, D.C. area, including all of the D.C.-based departments of the federal government as well as the Pentagon. The National Security Agency temptation was an itch I couldn't resist. NSA's telephone service was provided through a phone company switch in Laurel, Maryland, which we had already gained access to. Directory assistance listed the agency's public phone number as 301-688-6311. After randomly checking out several numbers with the same prefix, I proceeded on the reasonable hunch that NSA was assigned the entire prefix. Using a test function for switch technicians called Talk and Monitor, I was able to set up a circuit to listen to random calls in progress,
I popped in on one line and heard a man and a woman talking. Hardly able to believe I was actually listening in on the NSA, I was thrilled and nervous at the same time. The irony was great. I was wiretapping the world's biggest wiretappers. Okay, I'd proved I could do it. Time to get out. In a hurry. I didn't stay on long enough to hear what they were talking about, and I didn't want to know. If the call had been really sensitive, I'm sure it would have been on a secure line, but even so, it was way too risky. The likelihood of my getting caught was slim if I just did it once and didn't ever go back. The government never found out I had gained this access, and I wouldn't be including it here, except the statute of limitations has long run its course. For Lenny and me, it was thrilling every time we compromised another SCCS, like getting into higher and higher levels of a video game. This was the most significant hacking of my career because of the immense control and power it gave us over the phone systems of much of the United States. And yet, we never made any use of it. For us, the thrill lay simply in knowing we had gained the power. Pacific Bell eventually found out about the access we had gained. Yet we were never arrested and charged because, I later learned, company management was afraid of what would happen if others found out what I had been able to do and started trying to duplicate my efforts. Meanwhile, Lenny's accessing of Dockmaster had not gone unnoticed. NSA traced the break-in back to Hughes, which in turn traced it back to the computer room where Lenny was working on the night I visited. Security at Hughes questioned him first. Then the FBI summoned him for an official interview. Lenny hired an attorney who accompanied him to the meeting. Lenny told the agents he and I had never done anything with Dockmaster. He was grilled several times by Hughes' management. He stood his ground and wouldn't point a finger at me. Much later, though, to save his own neck, he claimed that I had hacked into Dockmaster while I visited Hughes that evening. When they asked why he'd lied about my not being involved in the first place, he said he'd been afraid because I'd threatened to kill him if he gave me up. Clearly, he was desperately trying to come up with an excuse why he lied to federal agents. The visitor's log showed that a Kevin Mitnick had indeed signed in as a guest of Lenny's. Of course, he was summarily canned from Hughes. 2 years later, I would be accused of possessing secret access codes for the NSA, when I actually only had the output of a Who Is command, which showed the names and telephone numbers of registered users with accounts on Dockmaster, something readily available to anyone with access to the ARPANET. Meanwhile, back at the computer school, the students weren't all guys. One of the girls was a cute, petite co-ed named Bonnie. I wasn't exactly the most attractive guy around, carrying all the extra weight I had put on ever since that friend from my preteen bus riding days had introduced me to junk food as a basic food group. I was weighing in at around 55 pounds overweight. Obese would have been a more than polite term. Still, I thought she was really cute. When we were both in the computer room working on school projects, I started sending messages to her across the room, asking her not to stop any of my programs that were running at a higher priority, and her replies were friendly enough. I asked her out to dinner. She said, "I can't. I'm engaged." But I had learned from my hacking not to give up easily. There's usually a way. A couple of days later, I asked again about dinner and told her she had a beautiful smile. And what do you know? This time, she accepted. Later, she told me she thought her fiancé might be lying to her about his finances, what cars he owned and how much he owed on them. I told her, "I can find out if you want." She said, "Yes, please." I had lucked my way into accessing TRW, the credit reporting company, while still in high school. Nothing clever about this. One night, I went out to the back of Galpin Ford in the San Fernando Valley and dug through the trash. It took about 15 minutes, but my little dumpster diving expedition paid off. I found a bunch of credit reports on people buying cars from the dealership. Incredibly, printed out on each report was Galpin's access code for TRW. Even more incredible, they were still printing out the access code on each credit report years later. In those days, TRW was very helpful to its clients. If you called in and gave a merchant's name and the correct access code and explained that you didn't know the procedure, the nice lady would talk you through every step of getting a person's credit report.
Very helpful to real clients. Very helpful as well to hackers like me. So when Bonnie said she'd like me to look into what her boyfriend was really up to, I had all the tricks I needed. A call to TRW and a few hours on the computer gave me his credit report, his bank balance, his property records. Suspicions confirmed. He was nowhere near as well off as he had been claiming, and some of his assets were frozen. DMV records showed he still had a car he told Bonnie he had sold. I felt bad about all this. I wasn't trying to undermine her relationship, but she broke off their engagement. Within 2 or 3 weeks, when she had gotten over her initial emotions about the breakup, we started dating. Though 6 years older than I was and considerably more experienced at this game, she thought I was smart and good-looking, despite my weight. This was my first serious relationship. I was soaring. Bonnie and I both liked Thai food and going to the movies, and she turned me on to hiking, something far out of my normal comfort zone, showing me the beautiful trails in the nearby San Gabriel Mountains. She was fascinated by my ability to gather information on people. And one thing more, a coincidence I still laugh at. My new girlfriend was having her salary paid and her tuition covered by one of my principal lifelong hacking targets, the phone company GTE. After finishing the prescribed half year for my certificate at the computer school, I ended up staying on a bit longer. The system admin, Ariel, had been trying to catch me getting administrator privileges on the school's VM CMS system for months. He finally nailed me by hiding behind a curtain in the terminal room while I was snooping inside his directory, catching me red-handed. But instead of booting me out of the program, he offered me a deal. He was impressed with the skills that had allowed me to hack into the school's computers, and if I would agree to write programs that would make their IBM mini computer more secure, he would label it an honors project. How about that? The school was training students in the esoteric knowledge of computers, but recruiting a student to improve its own security. That was a big first for me. I took it as a compliment and accepted the assignment. When I finished the project, I graduated with honors. Ariel and I eventually became friends. The Computer Learning Center had an inducement it used for signing up students. A number of high-profile companies made a practice of hiring its graduates, and one of them was Bonnie's employer, GTE, my hacking target for so many years. How fantastic was that? After interviewing with GTE's IT department, I was brought back for an interview with 3 people from Human Resources, then offered a job as a programmer. Dreams really did come true. No more hacking for me. I wouldn't need it. I'd be getting paid for doing what I loved at the place I loved doing it. The job began with employee orientation to teach new hires about the names and functions of all the different GTE computer systems. Hello, it was a telephone company. I could have been teaching the classes. But of course I sat there taking notes like everyone else. Cool new job. A daily quick stroll to the cafeteria for lunch with my girlfriend, a legitimate paycheck, I had it made. Walking through the offices, I'd smile at the hundreds of usernames and passwords that were right in front of my nose, written out on post-it notes. I was like a reformed drunk on a Jack Daniel's distillery tour, confident but nearly dizzy from imagining, what if? Bonnie and I would regularly have lunch with a friend of hers, a guy from their security department. I was always careful to turn my ID badge around. He obviously hadn't caught my full name when we were introduced, so why let him read it on my badge like a billboard flashing Phone Company Public Enemy Number 1? Altogether, this was one of the coolest times of my whole life. Who needed hacking? But only a week after I started, my new boss dropped a bomb on me. He handed me a security form for an all-access badge that would grant me entry to the data center 24/7. Since I would be on call for emergencies. Immediately, I knew I was going to get canned. As soon as staff from GTE Security looked at my form, they'd recognize my name and wonder how I had bypassed all of their security checks and actually been hired, as a programmer, no less. A couple of days later, I went to work with a bad gut feeling. Later that morning, my supervisor sent for me, and his boss, Russ Trombley, handed me my paycheck plus severance pay, saying he had to let me go because my references had not checked out. An obvious ruse. I had provided the names only of people who would say good things about me.
I was escorted back to my desk to gather my personal effects. Within minutes, a posse from security showed up, including the guy who had been having lunch with Bonnie and me. A couple of them started searching my box of floppies for any company property. Whatever. There was none, just legitimate software. The whole posse walked me to the door and all the way to my car. As I drove off into the distance, I glanced in my rearview mirror. They were all waving goodbye. My career at GTE had lasted a total of 9 days. I heard later that the guys from Pacific Bell Security razzed the hell out of their buddies at GTE, thinking it was hilarious that any company could be stupid enough to hire the notorious phone freaker Kevin Mitnick, whom Pacific Bell had been keeping a file on for years. One step back and one step forward. A computer learning center instructor who also worked at Security Pacific National Bank as an information security specialist suggested I apply for a job there. Over a period of weeks, I had 3 sets of interviews, the last one with a vice president of the bank. Then, a fairly lengthy wait. Finally, the phone call came. One of the other candidates has a college degree, but we've decided you're the person we want. The salary was $34,000, which for me was great. They sent an in-house memo around that announced, "Please welcome new employee Kevin Mitnick, who starts next week." Remember that article in the Los Angeles Times which covered my juvenile arrest and printed my name, a violation of law as well as a violation of my privacy because I was a minor? Well, one of the people at Security Pacific National Bank remembered that article too. The day before I was to start, I got a strange call from Sandra Lambert, the lady who'd hired me and who founded the Security Organization Information Systems Security Association, ISSA. The conversation was actually more like an interrogation. SL: Do you play hearts? Me: The card game? SL: Yes. I had a sinking feeling that the party was over. SL: Are you a ham radio operator with the call sign WA6VPS? Me: Yes. SL: Do you dig around in the dumpsters behind office buildings? Me: Uh-oh. Only when I'm hungry. My attempt at humor fell. She said goodbye and hung up. I received a phone call from Human Resources the next day withdrawing the employment offer. Once again, my past had come back to bite me in the ass. Sometime later, media outlets received a press release from Security Pacific National Bank announcing a $400 million loss for the quarter. The release was a phony. It wasn't really from the bank, which had not, in fact, lost money in that quarter. Of course, the higher-ups at the bank were sure I was behind it. I didn't learn about any of this until months later at a court hearing when prosecutors told the judge that I had committed this malicious act. Thinking back, I remembered telling DePayne that my job offer had been pulled. Years afterward, I asked him if he had been behind that press release. He vehemently denied it. The fact is, I didn't do it. That wasn't my style. I've never practiced any kind of vicious retribution. But the phony press release became another part of the myth of Kevin Mitnick. Still, I had Bonnie in my life, one of the best things that had ever happened to me. But have you ever felt that something was so good it couldn't possibly last? 7. Hitched in haste. Bonnie recently said that she still remembers how much fun Kevin was, how sweet he was. I felt the same about her. There had been other girls I'd had crushes on, but Bonnie was a first for me in how serious I felt, a first in how much I cared. We enjoyed so many of the same things, even down to the Reese's peanut butter cups that we'd drive out of our way to pick up at a 7-Eleven on our way home. You probably know the satisfaction when you're just comfortable and happy being in one particular person's company. There was no doubt that having her there for me after those 2 rapid-fire job losses was exactly what the doctor ordered. I was spending so much time at her place that I began moving some of my clothes there. We never really decided, okay, let's live together. It just sort of happened. We loved biking together. We loved going to the beach with a bottle of wine. We loved hiking in the Chantry Flat in Arcadia, a beautiful area with waterfalls that's right in Los Angeles County but feels like being in a forest. Really cool. Such a refreshing escape for a pale guy like me who sat in front of a computer all day and all night. I didn't even mind that she was a lazy housekeeper with a big pile of her dirty clothes, usually occupying space on the bedroom floor. I've never been a neat freak like my parents, but I do like things tidy and organized. The two of us were alike in so many other ways that when it came to the condition of the apartment, I just closed my eyes. Since I didn't have a job, I signed up for an extension course at UCLA in Westwood, not far from us. Bonnie went with me to register. But it was a deception. The first time in our relationship that I was, in a sense, cheating on her. I'd go out 3 evenings a week saying I was going to class, and instead I'd drive over to Lenny DeCicco's work and hack with him until almost sunup. It was a pretty rotten thing to do. On the nights when I didn't go out, I'd sit at my computer in the apartment, using Bonnie's telephone line for hacking while she read by herself, watched television by herself, and then went to bed by herself. I could say it was my way of handling the disappointment of those two almost, but oh, never mind, jobs, but I'd be lying. Sure, I was having problems handling the massive disappointment, but that wasn't the reason. The real reason was simply that I was in the thrall of a powerful obsession. Though that had to be frustrating for her, she was somehow as accepting as I was about her less-than-admirable housekeeping. After a few months of living together, we both knew we were committed to the relationship. We were in love. We started talking about getting married. And we began saving money. Whatever was left over from my paycheck, I was hired by Froman's Delicatessen to migrate them over to a point-of-sale system. I would convert into $100 bills that I stashed in the inside breast pocket of a jacket in our coat closet. I was 23 years old, living in my girlfriend's apartment, and spending virtually every waking hour on my computer. I was David on my PC, attacking the Goliath networks of the major telephone companies throughout the United States. The phone company control systems used a bastardized version of Unix, which I wanted to learn more about. A company in Northern California called Santa Cruz Operations, or SCO, was developing a Unix-based operating system called Xenix for PCs. If I could get my hands on a copy of the source code, that would give me a chance to study the inner workings of the operating system on my own computer. From Pacific Bell, I was able to obtain SCO's secret dial-up numbers for its computer network and then manipulated an employee into revealing her username and changing her password to a new password that I had provided, which gave me access. At one point, while immersed in studying the details of SCO's system, trying to locate the source code I wanted to study, I noticed a system admin was watching my every move. I sent him a message. "Why are you watching me?" To my surprise, he answered. "It's my job," his message said. Just to see how far he'd allow me to go, I wrote back that I wanted my own account on the system. He created an account for me, even giving me the username I requested, Hacker. Knowing that he'd be keeping the account under surveillance, I just distracted him by poking around at nothing in particular. I was able to locate the code I wanted, but in the end, I never tried to download it, because the transfer would have taken forever over my 2400 baud modem. But that wasn't going to be the end of this tale. Bonnie came home from work one day at the beginning of June to find everything in disarray. We had been robbed. She paged me. I called and I could hear the alarm and upset in her voice. I asked her to check my coat pocket for the money I'd been saving for our wedding, but then she noticed that my stash of $100 bills, totaling about $3,000, had been neatly laid out on the kitchen table, along with a search warrant. We hadn't been robbed, we'd been raided by officers of the Santa Cruz Police Department. Santa Cruz! I knew it had to be connected to my nighttime hacking excursions into the computers of Santa Cruz operations. When Bonnie said my computer and disks were gone, my world immediately crumbled. I told her to quickly pack some clothes and meet me. I knew there would be a lot of trouble coming my way. I needed to get a lawyer to do damage control.
fast. Bonnie joined me at a local park, and my mom came too. I told them both it wasn't a big deal since I had just poked around. I hadn't damaged any of the SCO files or even downloaded their source code. I wasn't as worried about dealing with the law as I was about the pain and suffering I was bringing down on these two and Graham, the most important people in my life. Mom drove home. I took Bonnie to a nearby motel. She was upset, feeling violated. If she had walked out on me right then, I would have deserved it. Instead, without hesitation, she showed her true colors, her loyalty. Her attitude wasn't, "What have you done to me?" It was more, "What do we do now?" The next morning, she called her work and asked to take some vacation time for a family emergency. Her boss told her that some police officers had shown up wanting to interview her. My first thought was that since I had been hacking from her apartment and on her telephone, they were assuming that she was the hacker. But then I concluded that their strategy was probably to use arresting my girlfriend as a bargaining chip. Admit everything or your girlfriend goes to jail. I spent the next few days calling lawyers, explaining the situation, making plans. The way Bonnie remembers it, we cried a lot together, but we stuck by each other. Why didn't she just walk out? I was crazy about Kevin, she says today. We were able to release some amount of anxiety and worry by spending a lot of time making love. I felt really sorry that I had put Bonnie in this position and that I caused my mom and grandmother such anxiety, and I guess Bonnie and I found comfort in that basic outlet. Aunt Chickie drove Bonnie and me down to the Los Angeles County Sheriff's West Hollywood Station. We turned ourselves in, and Chickie immediately posted our bond, $5,000 each. Somehow, the police neglected to fingerprint and photograph us. Because of this major procedural error, there was no arrest record created for either of us. Still today, there is no official record that I was ever arrested on the Santa Cruz operations charge. Please don't tell anyone. Over the next few months, for every appearance we had to make in the Santa Cruz courts, I had to buy 4 round-trip airplane tickets. Bonnie was using a different attorney, plus spring for hotel rooms, a rental car, and meals. Both of the attorneys had required a retainer up front. So much for the money I'd been saving for the wedding. The entire $3,000 went to pay my attorney's retainer. Mom and Graham loaned me money to pay for Bonnie's attorney and all the other expenses. So, we didn't have the money anymore for a proper wedding. But it was worse than that. There isn't any loving, romantic way to put this. I told Bonnie we needed to get married so she couldn't testify against me and also so she could visit me if I landed in jail, which was looking like the way things were headed. I gave Bonnie a diamond engagement ring and we were married by a minister who conducted weddings in his home in Woodland Hills. Graham was there, along with my mom and her current boyfriend, deli entrepreneur Arnie Froman. None of Bonnie's family joined us. Her mother was understandably furious at the situation I had landed her daughter in. It wasn't the magical occasion so many girls dream about when they're young. Bonnie wore pants, a top, and flip-flops. She hadn't bothered to even attempt to put herself together. Afterward, we all headed over to our apartment, Graham bringing a platter of food. The legal picture turned from bad to worse. On top of the criminal charges, SCO filed a $1.4 million lawsuit against me for damages and ditto against Bonnie. Then a little sun broke through. It turned out the lawsuits were just for leverage. The opposing lawyers said the folks at SCO would drop the civil suits if I would tell them how I'd hacked in. They had never been able to figure it out. Of course I agreed, and sat down with a system admin named Stephen Marr, who acted as if he thought we were going to chat like good buddies. I treated it the same way I would have if it had been a deposition. He asked questions, I answered. But there wasn't all that much to tell. No high-tech hacking secrets. I told him how I had simply called a secretary and schmoozed her into giving me her login name and changing her password to one I provided. No big deal. Though Bonnie's mother wouldn't come to the wedding, she did give us a wedding reception at her home in San Dimas. This time Bonnie wore a wedding dress and I was in a rented tux. My dad and my brother, Adam, were there, and of course my mom and Graham, as well as Bonnie's sister and brothers, and even Bonnie's ex-boyfriend. This was a much happier day than the real wedding, complete with wedding cake and a photographer.
The criminal charges for the SCO break-in turned out better than I could have hoped. The charges against Bonnie were dropped, and my attorney, who knew the prosecutor, Michael Barton, got me a good deal. For anyone else, for what was technically a first offense since my juvenile records were sealed, the case would have been charged as a misdemeanor, but because I was Kevin Mitnick with a badass reputation, the prosecutor initially insisted on charging me with a felony, even though my trespass into SCO's network still amounted to only a misdemeanor under the law. I agreed to admit to the trespass to settle the case and get the charges against Bonnie dropped. I wouldn't have to serve any jail time, only pay a way modest $216 fine and be on summary probation for 36 months, meaning that I wouldn't have to report to a probation officer. The only other obvious condition was that I had to promise not to commit any crimes. A few days later, I drove up to Santa Cruz for the return of the stuff that had been seized. The cops gave me back my computer terminal, but not the disks, which worried me because those incriminating disks contained evidence of my hacks into Pacific Bell, among other interesting places. Another box that they did return, though, they must not have looked at very carefully or cared. It held Bonnie's pot stash and bong pipe. Then again, this was Santa Cruz, with a small-town police department. There was an aftermath to the Santa Cruz story. As I had feared, the Santa Cruz detectives apparently got around to looking at those computer disks and turned information over to Pacific Bell about what I had been doing with its systems. Pacific Bell security was alarmed enough to generate an internal memo to all managers, which I found out about in a most unlikely way. A Pacific Bell employee named Bill Cook, also a ham operator who frequently used the infamous 147.435 megahertz repeater in Los Angeles, read the memo on the air just to antagonize me. Of course I had to see the memo for myself. How could I get it? I contacted Louis DePayne at work and asked him to temporarily reprogram the fax machine there so incoming calls would be answered by a machine that said it belonged to Pacific Bell security. Then I dialed into the phone company switch that handled the telephone service for Pacific Bell Security and reprogrammed the phone line for its fax machine so it would call forward to the phone number for the machine at Lewis's work. That took care of the preparations. Then I called the office of Pacific Bell Vice President Frank Spiller. His executive secretary answered. I said I was calling from Pacific Bell Security and gave the name of one of the actual security investigators. Maybe I said I was Steve Doherty. I asked, did Frank get the memo on the Kevin Mitnick case? What's it about? She asked. A hacker who's been breaking into our computers. Oh, yes, right. I've got it right here. I said, I think we sent you an older revision that has since been updated. Can you fax the version you have to me? I gave her the internal fax number for Pacific Bell Security in Northern California. Sure, she said. I'll do it right now. As soon as Lewis got the fax, he refaxed it to me, then he and I both undid our setup steps. Here's the list of things the memo said had been found on my floppy disks. Mitnick's compromise of all Southern California SCC ESAC computers. On file were the names, logins, passwords, and home telephone numbers for Northern and Southern ESAC employees. The dial-up numbers and circuit identification documents for SCC computers and data kits. The commands for testing and seizing trunk testing lines and channels. The commands and logins for Cosmos wire centers for Northern and Southern California. The commands for line monitoring and the seizure of dial tone. References to the impersonation of Southern California security agents and ESAC employees to obtain information. The commands for placing, terminating, and originating traps. The addresses of Pacific Bell locations and the electronic door lock access codes for the following Southern California central offices: ELS G12, LSAN 06, LSAN 12, LSAN 15, LSAN 56, AVLN 11, HLWD 01, HWTH 01, IGWD 01, LOMT 11, and SNPD 01. Intercompany electronic mail detailing new login, password procedures, and safeguards. The worksheet of an Unix encryption reader hacker file. If successful, this program could break into any Unix system at will. I imagine a lot of people in the company must have been more than a little upset to find out how deeply I had penetrated their systems,
bypassing all of their elaborate security safeguards. Based on what had been found on those disks, I was just stunned that the FBI didn't show up at my door. Several months later, by the fall of 1988, I was back at work with Don David Wilson at Franmark. Bonnie was still at GTE, though she was sure their security department had tried to find evidence that she had been hacking into company computers. We were saving money again, trying to put together enough for the down payment on a house. There were some nice places we could afford, but they were so far out of town that the commute would have been daunting and wearing on our nerves and patience. Trying to support our home ownership goal, my mom offered us the spare bedroom in her home so we could save on rent and build our down payment fund quicker. Though neither Bonnie nor I much liked the idea, we decided to give it a try. Our living with my mom turned out to be a bad idea. As eager as she was to make it work for us, we simply had no privacy. Bonnie would later complain in a personal memo that she left behind at my mom's that she was reluctant and a bit bitter about it. We were growing apart, and I was getting deeper and deeper back into hacking, spending all my days at work at Franmark and my nights almost until sunup with Lenny DeCiccio, largely focused on hacking into Digital Equipment Corporation. When Lenny told me he was signing up to take a computer course at nearby Pierce College, I said I'd sign up as well to keep him company, despite my earlier run-in with the chair of the computer science department, which had led to my quitting the program. It turned out the administrators had not forgotten me, but I didn't know it at the time. One day, Lenny and I went into the student computer room, which had a bunch of terminals connected to a Microvax VMS system. We hacked into the machine quickly and obtained all privileges. Lenny had written a script that would allow us to make a backup of the entire system. We had no real use for it. We just planned to treat it as a trophy. So once we got in, Lenny put a cartridge tape into the computer tape drive and ran his script to start the backup, and we left. We were going to return for it a few hours later after the copy had finished. A bit later, as we were walking across campus, I got a page from Elliot Moore, a longtime friend I hadn't been in touch with for a while. I went to a payphone to call him back. "Are you at Pierce College?" he asked. "Yes." "Did you leave a tape in the tape drive?" "Oh, shit, how did you know?" I said. "Don't go back to the computer room," he warned me. "They're waiting for you." By some strange chance, Elliot had been in the computer lab when the instructor noticed the blinking light on the Microvax tape drive. It was obvious that someone had inserted a cartridge tape and was copying some files. The computer science instructor, Pete Schleppenbach, had immediately suspected us. Elliot overheard the instructor discussing the situation with another staff member and called me right away. If he hadn't, we would have walked right into a trap. The college later contacted the LAPD to report the incident. Since we never went to pick up the tape, they had no evidence, and we were allowed to continue as students, attending classes and using the computer lab. But the LAPD kept an eye on us, positioning their team on the classroom rooftops and trailing us for days. Apparently, attempting to copy student lab work became a top priority. You'd think they'd have more interesting cases to work on. At night, they'd follow us to Lenny's work, where we stayed at his office hacking until the wee hours of the morning. They knew we were up to no good, but they couldn't prove anything. I guess the Pierce College folks were disappointed and weren't ready to drop it. I noticed a DEC company vehicle in the college parking lot, so I called the local DEC field office for Los Angeles and said I was from accounts payable at Pierce College and asked what support they were providing at the time. "Oh," the guy told me, "we're trying to help you catch some hackers." At a terminal in the Pierce computer lab, I was able to examine a memory location from my student account that showed me that all security auditing was enabled on my account. Lenny checked his account using the same technique. Security auditing was enabled on it as well. The guy from DEC was closeted in a small room with a computer and printer, watching everything we were doing from our student accounts. I discovered this by showing up early one day before the tech arrived and following him to the room. I thought this was a bit overkill, since the system was only used by students to complete their lab work and not connected to any network or phone line. But I found a way to keep him busy. I wrote a very simple script that listed the files in my directory, over and over. Since the security auditing was designed to send a detailed alert for every file opened or read, I knew his printer would be working non-stop. I could picture the guy closed up in his tiny room, pulling his hair out that his printer kept running until it was out of paper. And as soon as he would load more paper, the file lists would start printing out again. A short while later, the instructor pulled Lenny and me out of the computer room and accused us of typing unauthorized commands. I asked, "Is doing a directory of my own files unauthorized?" Both Lenny and I were sent to the dean for further proceedings. Over the next several weeks, Pierce's administrators held a kangaroo court hearing on our case. They still suspected we were behind the hacking incident, but still couldn't prove it. No eyewitnesses, no fingerprints, no confessions. Nonetheless, Lenny and I were both expelled from Pierce based on circumstantial evidence. 8. Lex Luthor. Lenny and I wanted to get the source code for Digital Equipment Corporation's VMS operating systems so we could study it to find security flaws. We would also be able to look for developers' comments about fixing security problems, which would let us work backward and figure out what those problems were and how we could exploit them. We also wanted to be able to compile parts of the operating system ourselves, so it would be easier for us to install some backdoor patches in the systems we compromised. Our plan was to launch a social engineering attack on DEC to get into the VMS development cluster. I got the dial-up number for the VMS development modem pool. When Lenny was at work, he went to the terminal box for the building to find a fax line belonging to another tenant. Because a lot of companies had office suites in the same building, he could punch down someone else's line on an unused cable pair that went into VPA's computer room, and no one would be able to trace our outgoing calls. Meanwhile, I went to the Country Inn Hotel near his office and used a payphone to call Lenny. Once I had him on the line on one phone, I used another payphone to call DEC's main number in Nashua, New Hampshire, where its labs and developers were. Then I stood there, between the two phones, with a receiver held up to each ear. I told the woman who answered in Nashua that I worked at DEC too, then asked where the computer room was and got the phone number for operations. When I called that department, I used the name of someone in development and asked if operations supported the Star Cluster group of VMS systems that were used by VMS development. The DEC employee said yes. I then covered that mouthpiece with my hand and spoke to Lenny through the other one, telling him to dial the modem number. Next, I told the operator to type in a show users command to show who was logged in. If you were in the process of logging in, as Lenny was, it would show this by displaying login, along with the device name of the terminal that was being used for logging in. This is what she saw on her display. VMS user processes at 9th June 1988, 2:23 p.m., total number of users, 3. Number of processes, 3. Username, Goldstein, node, star, process, AAA, AAA, underscore, FTA2. Name, PID, 21812D, terminal, FTA2. Username, Piper, node, star, process, DYSLI. Name, PID, 21811A, terminal, FTA1. Username, login. Name, PID, 21811E, terminal, TTG4. The login indicated the type of device Lenny was on, TTG4. I then asked the operator to type in a spawn command. Spawn, /no wait/no log/no notify/input=TTG4:output=TTG4:. Because she wasn't keying in usernames or passwords, she didn't think anything about what I was asking her to do. She should have known what a spawn command did, but apparently operators rarely used it, so evidently she didn't recognize it. That command created a logged-in process on the modem device that Lenny was connected to in the context of the operator's account. As soon as the operator typed in the command, a $ prompt appeared on Lenny's terminal. That meant he was logged in with the full privileges of the operator. When the $ showed up, Lenny was so excited that he started shouting into the phone, "I've got a prompt! I've got a prompt!" I held Lenny's phone away from my head and said calmly to the operator, "Would you excuse me? I'll be right back." I pressed that phone against my leg to mute the mouthpiece, picked up the other phone, and told Lenny, "Shut up!" Then I went back to my call with the operator. Lenny immediately checked to see if security audits were enabled. They were. So rather than setting up a new account for us, which would have raised suspicion by triggering an audit alarm, he just changed the password on a dormant account that had all system privileges. Meanwhile, I thanked the operator and told her that she could log out now. Afterward, Lenny dialed back up and logged into the dormant account with his new password. Once we had compromised VMS development, our objective was to get access to the latest version of the VMS source code. It wasn't too difficult. When we listed the disks that were mounted, none of them was labeled VMS_source. Nothing like making it easy for us. At that point, we uploaded a small tool designed to disable any security audits in a way that wouldn't trigger an alarm. Once the alarms had been disabled, we set up a couple of user accounts with full privileges and changed a few more passwords on other privileged accounts that hadn't been used in at least 6 months. Our plan was to move a copy of the latest version of the VMS source code to USC so we could maintain full access to the code even if we got booted off the Star Cluster. After setting up our new accounts, we also went into the email of Andy Goldstein. He had been a member of the original VMS design team at Digital and was well known throughout the VMS community as an operating system guru. We knew he also worked with VMS security issues, so we figured his email would be a good place to look for information about the latest security issues DEC was trying to fix. We discovered that Goldstein had received security bug reports from a guy named Neil Clift. I quickly learned that Clift was a grad student at Leeds University in England, studying organic chemistry, but he was obviously also a computer enthusiast with a unique talent. He was very skilled at finding vulnerabilities in the VMS operating system, which he faithfully alerted DEC to. What he didn't realize was that now he was alerting me as well. This laid the groundwork for what would prove to be a gold mine for me. While searching through Goldstein's emails, I found one that contained a full analysis of a clever patch for Login Out, the VMS login program. The patch was developed by a group of German hackers who belonged to something they called the Chaos Computer Club, CCC. A few members of the group focused on developing patches for particular VMS programs that enabled you to take full control of the system. Their VMS Login Out patch also modified the login program in several ways, instructing it to secretly store user passwords in a hidden area of the system authorization file, to cloak the user with invisibility, and to disable all security alarms when anyone logged into the system with a special password. Newspaper stories about the Chaos Computer Club mentioned the name of the group's leader. I tracked down the guy's number and called him up. By this time, my own reputation in the hacking community was starting to grow, so he recognized my name. He said I should talk to another member of the group who, sadly, turned out to be in the end stages of cancer. When I called him at the hospital, I explained that I'd obtained an analysis of the club's backdoor patches for the VMS Login Out and Show programs and thought they were wickedly clever. I asked if he had any other cool tools or patches he'd be willing to share. The guy was both super cool and talkative, and he offered to send me some information. Unfortunately, he said he'd have to send it by snail mail since the hospitals didn't have a computer. Several weeks later, I received a packet of printouts detailing some of the hacks the group had created that weren't already in the public domain. Expanding on the Chaos Computer Club's work, Lenny and I developed some improved patches that added even more functionality. Essentially, the CCC created a framework that we then built upon. As new versions of VMS came out, Lenny and I kept adapting our patches. Because Lenny always worked at companies that had VMS systems, we were able to test our patches on his work systems and deploy them into systems we wanted to maintain access to. After some major DEC clients were compromised, the company's programmers wrote a security tool that would detect the chaos patch. Lenny and I located the detection software and analyzed it, then simply modified our version of the chaos patch so DEC's tool wouldn't be able to find it anymore. It was quite simple, really. This made it easier for us to install our patch into numerous VMS systems
on Digital's worldwide network known as EasyNet. If locating the code wasn't hard, transferring it was. This was a lot of code. To reduce the volume of code, we compressed it. Each directory contained hundreds of files. We'd compress all of them in a single file and encrypt it so that if anyone found it, it would look like garbage. The only way to retain access to the files so we'd be able to study them at leisure was to find systems on DEC's EasyNet that connected to the ARPANET, giving us the ability to transfer them outside DEC's network. We only found four systems on EasyNet that had ARPANET access, but we could use all four to move the code out, piece by piece. Our original plan to store a copy of the code at USC proved a little short-sighted. First of all, we realized we should use more than one storage location for redundancy, so all that work wouldn't go to waste if the code was discovered. But it turned out there was an even bigger issue. The code base was humongous. Trying to store it all in one location would run too big a risk of being detected. So we began spending a lot of time hacking into systems on the ARPANET, looking for other safe storage lockers. It began to feel like getting the code from DEC was the easy part, while the big challenge was figuring out where to stash copies of it. We gained access to computer systems at Patuxent River Naval Air Station in Maryland and other places. Unfortunately, the system at Patuxent River had minimal storage available. We also tried to set ourselves up on the computer systems at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California, using our customized version of the Chaos Patch. JPL eventually realized that one of their systems had been compromised, possibly because they were watching for any unauthorized changes to the VMS login out and show programs. They must have reverse-engineered the binaries to identify how the programs were being modified and decided it was the Computer Chaos Club who had gained access. JPL management went to the media with that version of the story, which led to huge news coverage about the German hackers who had been caught breaking into the JPL computers. Lenny and I chuckled over the incident, but at the same time, we were a bit nervous because we were detected. Once we started the transfers, we had to keep them going night and day, moving the code bit by bit. It was a very slow process. The dial-up speed of the connection at the time, if you could even use the word speed, was a maximum of T1 speeds, which was about 1.544 megabits per second. Today, even cell phones are much faster than that. Soon, DEC detected our activity. The guys responsible for keeping the systems up and operational could tell that something was going on because of the heavy network traffic in the middle of the night. To make matters worse, they discovered that their available disk space was disappearing. They didn't usually have a lot of volume on the system. It would be counting in megabytes, whereas we were moving gigabytes. The nighttime activity and the disappearing disk space pointed to a security issue. They quickly changed all the account passwords and deleted all the files we stored on the system. It was a challenge, but Lenny and I weren't deterred. We just kept hacking back in, night after night, despite their best efforts. In fact, because the staff and users of the system didn't realize that we had their personal workstations under our control and could intercept their keystrokes, it was easy for us to immediately obtain their new login credentials every time they changed them. DEC's network engineers could see all along that lots of large files were being transferred, but they couldn't figure out how to stop it. Our unrelenting assault had them convinced that they were under some kind of corporate espionage attack by international mercenaries who'd been hired to steal their flagship technology. We read their theories about us in their emails. It was clearly driving them crazy. I could always log on to see how far they were getting and what they were going to try next. We did our best to keep them chasing red herrings along the way. Because we had full access to EasyNet, we could dial in from the United Kingdom and other countries throughout the world. They couldn't identify our entry points because we were constantly changing them. We were facing a similar challenge at USC. Administrators there had likewise noticed that disk space on a few micro-VAXs was disappearing. We'd start transferring data at night, and they'd come on and kill the network connection. We'd start it up again, and they'd bring the system down for the night. We'd just wait them out, then start up our transfer again. This game continued for months. Sometimes between fending off the system admins, grappling with the gigabytes of code, and putting up with the painfully slow bandwidth, we felt like we were trying to suck an ocean through a straw, but we endured. Once all the VMS source code had been moved to several systems at USC, we needed to put it on magnetic tape so we could sift through the code without worrying about being tracked back while it dialed into EasyNet. Moving the source code onto tape was a three-man operation.